Hi, I'm Neeti Mittal.
And I'm Meg Hennessy.
And this is Progressing Planning, a podcast series on the role of planning in fostering change in contemporary society. In this episode, we'll be talking with Dr. Mara Ferreri, senior researcher at the Beyond Inhabitation Lab at the Inter-University Department of Regional and Urban Studies and Planning at Politecnico di Torino. Her research focuses on issues of urban temporariness, precarity, commons, and housing justice. She's joining us today to talk about her research on property guardianship in the UK.
Thank you, Mara, for joining us today. It's a pleasure to have you here.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
So, Mara, to begin with, could you tell us more about what property guardianship is and how it works?
Yes, thank you. So, defining property guardianship is kind of difficult because there isn't a statutory definition of the practice in the United Kingdom. It could be said that it's a form of intermediation between ownership of vacant building and practices of securing and safeguarding them. And the way in which this practice takes place is through living in guardians. So property guardianship companies, which are these intermediaries, basically connect guardians and owners through this live-in security. And in contrast to traditional security guardians, however, are not paid workers. So we're not talking about, in a sense, a traditional form of security, but rather a way in which people can live paying sometimes relatively lower monthly fees to safeguard these properties. I think what is important to mention is that the guardians are granted a license to occupy, so that's not a tenancy, although there have been different legal challenges to this. But a license to occupy means that there is a contractual right to occupy the premises, but there is no exclusive possession. And so when we sign a tenancy agreement, we have exclusive possession to that property, which means that nobody can enter without our permission. When you're a guardian, you are subjected to inspections, and that clearly is curtailing your right to privacy within the premises. Maybe the other important element to talk about is that guardianship companies, in a sense, can initiate quite a lucrative business, because in many cases they are paid by both parties. So we have, on the one hand, property owners who pay for a service, which is the security, and we have guardians who pay a license fee, which is a monthly fee, to inhabit the premises. So they are kind of receiving money from both sides. However, in some cases, that's not always the case, but it is the norm.
Okay, that's really interesting. And how big is this practice in the UK in terms of how many guardians are out there?
So again, it is difficult to estimate, to have a sort of an accurate estimate, because there is no such thing as a registry of guardianship. And often, well, the companies normally don't publish that kind of data. So the UK government's Department for Levelling Up, Housing and Communities published an estimate in April 2022 of between 5,000 and 7,000 people living across the UK. The exact number is unknown. I'm quoting from their figures. And this figure really needs to be understood as a snapshot at any moment in time. It doesn't really give us a measure of how many people have gone through property guardianship at some point in the past year or 10 years. And I think that's quite important to mention, because many people might be property guardian just for a few weeks or for a few months. I've interviewed people who have done it for a short period of time, and I've interviewed people who have done it maybe over 10 years with different companies and in different properties. So it really, we are talking about a transient population, and we're also talking about a phenomenon which is quite difficult to capture. It's worth noting that the published estimates by the government show an increase since 2020. So in 2020, it was around 4,000 people. So it may be possible to presume that there has been an increase, although it is difficult to ascertain. In terms of the industry, property guardianship companies arrived from the Netherlands, where the practice originated in the 1990s. They arrived in to the UK in 2001. And in 2017, with my co-authors, Gloria Dawson and Alexander Vasudevan, we realized a survey of companies. We identified 33 registered in the United Kingdom. There are probably more, although there might be some fluctuation there. And at least 22 of them had been founded since the global financial crisis in 2008. So when we were looking at this, we saw, in a sense, a growing trend, a growing variety also of properties, of property guardianship companies. And when looking at this variety, there were geographical locations. Most of them had offices in London, clearly, but also in other major cities across the UK. Some of them only operated in England. Some of them had offices in Scotland and Wales. And in terms of our survey, we distinguished between three types of companies. Type one is the type of company that only provides living security. So property guardianship is their main profit-making activity. Type two are property guardianship companies that try to implement a form of more ethical kind of guardianship. So normally they're registered as not-for-profit, and normally they target and or have components that include volunteering. And the third type that we began to see at the time was security, traditional security companies that had kind of started doing property guardianship as a niche within their main activities.
Interesting. So taking the case study of London, which is currently in the midst of what is widely believed to be a housing crisis, do you think it represents a possible solution for that in terms of providing certain sections of the population with an affordable housing option?
That's a difficult question to answer because, in a sense, for those who are already living as guardians, it is a solution to some needs, for sure. However, I would respond in two ways. The first is by saying that London has been affected by an endemic housing crisis for decades. The problem is not so much supply. The problem is affordability. And so within this crisis of affordability, property guardianship provides a mechanism for dwelling, often slightly below market rent. But then we must understand that market rent is already completely unaffordable to vast swathes of the population. The second answer, I suppose, is that guardianship is a form of dwelling, but it's not housing. In the sense that it's not recognized as a housing tenure. The non-statutory guidance of the Department for Leveling Up, Housing and Communities states that it is not an encouraged form of housing tenure because guardians can be asked to live in conditions that do not meet the standards expected in residential properties. So what I perhaps failed to mention earlier is that many of the buildings, of the vacant buildings where guardians that guardians inhabit through this scheme might not be residential properties. And even when they are residential properties, they might not be at the level, at the standards of living that would be protected by kind of statutory living standards. So we are talking about people living sometimes in unsafe conditions, sometimes with limited, for instance, limited heating or electric showers. There have been over the years a number of situations where this has posed health hazards. And there is also, of course, that question I mentioned earlier about exclusive possession and the lack of privacy. I also wanted to say that in terms of providing a solution, the requirements to become a property guardian limited to a section of the population. Normally, to be considered for a guardianship, candidates need to provide up to three references, proof of savings or regular income. They must not have a criminal record. The application procedure often includes a vetting interview. Depending on the type of property, guardian company, the interview might lean more towards, for instance, the values of the guardians, or it might lean towards some soft skills or actual physical skills in the maintenance of buildings. So we are talking about something that definitely excludes a section of the population. There is also the minor question of not being able to have children in these guardianship companies, and this is guardianship properties, and this is something that in 2017 became a somewhat high profile issue when one of these companies in Camden allegedly began the proceeding to evict a female guardian who was pregnant and had given birth to a child. And this was, it became quite a high profile case because Sean Berry at the time sort of really took on this this case and initiated the London Assembly Housing Committee's inquiry into property guardianship, which kind of tried to, in a sense, disentangle the duties and obligations of local governments in relation to the people who were living as guardians within the boundaries of their boroughs. And in this particular case, this was a guardian who was living in a council-owned property through a property guardianship agency. And so some of the inquiry and some of the publications that emerged from that inquiry are quite useful in that sense, to give a sense of how widespread the use was by local governments and by public institutions, and also what were the issues there in terms of course, a duty to care and other kind of duties against discrimination.
Thanks, Mara. It seems like quite a complex issue in the UK at the moment, and I understand that it is being used as part of the estate regeneration process, or what is also being labelled as state-led gentrification. Could you tell us a little bit about that?
Yes, so the London Assembly Housing Committee's inquiry also emerged from a Freedom of Information request, which had identified a number of different organizations in the public sector that were using property guardianship. And in 2016, they realized, they identified that there were at least 24 out of the 33 local governments that were at the time using or had used in the 5 years prior property guardianship. In many cases, publicly owned building, residential buildings, in many cases, in the process of being vacant because of either large-scale refurbishment or a demolition. So that's the connection with the estates. And this is something that I discussed in my article with Alex Vasudevan, published in GeoForum in 2019. Sometimes the vacancy kind of marks what is an edge, a material but also a conceptual edge, in the production of the city, of a certain type of city, and particularly council estates, their refurbishment, their stock transfer to third sector organization, become then sites of this edge. This is something, so the use of property guardianship in council estate owned by councils is one component of that. Another component is council estates, their own or managed by housing associations. And this became quite commonplace. Some examples, the Guinness Trust, Loughborough Estate in Lambeth, Poplar Harca, Brownfield Estate in Tower Hamlets, where the Balfron Tower is located, Graham Park Estate in the London Borough of Barnet. All of these are examples that over the past 10 years have used property guardianship, sometimes several different property guardianship companies, to secure the premises. And in some cases, the argument was made that since these are long drawn out processes, it is unspeakable to use them to house people who might otherwise not have access to the private rental sector, or who are simply in the position to accept a much more precarious form of living, which is not protected by tenancy rights. And in your question, you're raising the question of state-led gentrification. So there are a number of different scholars working on this topic, Loretta Lees, Paul Watt, and others who have used this term basically to talk about the process through which it is the government, central government or local government, driving processes of socio-economic demographic change. In the case of council housing, with Loretta Lees, we argued in our cities paper that council estates have become a sort of a final frontier of gentrification in London and their demolition, clearly signaling this shift, socioeconomic shift, partly because often this demolition leads to a net loss of council housing. So even when there is a replacement, that might not be like for like, so it might not be council, but it might be social housing, housing association provided, which are normally more expensive, but also often their replacement. So not only there is a net loss, but there is also a replacement which much more expensive housing, either for sale or for rent. And so we are talking about processes that have been proven now over the last decade or so to actually trigger forms of gentrification in many boroughs.
That's really interesting. So in a lot of your work, you link the rise of property guardianship as indicative of an increasing sense of urban precarity in cities like London. Could you tell us what you mean by precarity and how property guardianship is linked to this idea?
So when we discuss precarity, we are in a sense talking about precariousness and insecurity, but we are also going a bit beyond that. So we use the concept of precarity to talk about the intersection of new conditions of heightened economic, social, and political insecurity, but also the normalization of the forms of subjectivation and also the structures of feelings that come with it. So it's not just about material conditions, but it's also the transformations which affect increasingly large sections of urban population in terms of what they might be anticipating and expecting their life and their ways of living to be. With Gloria Dawson and Alex Vasudevan, we have written about precarity in relation to property guardianship, both in terms of the everydayness of this condition, but also in terms of the ways in which guardians understand their position in cities and understand their position in relation to the form of living that guardianship enables, but also constrains. And we are, of course, positioning this in relation to contemporary neoliberal processes, particularly the induced insecurity which comes with the normalization of temporary labor regimes, so the increasing precarization of work, the decimation of social services, the demolition in many ways of those kind of material safety nets for large sections of the population, such as public housing in the forms of council housing or social rented housing, and also this normalization that comes with it. And what was interesting there is that most of the guardians that we interviewed had multiple jobs. Many of them were educated. Not necessarily everyone was, in a sense, part of this homogeneous profile. And in fact, other studies have also shown that there is a wide variety of people who live as guardians, but in most cases, we're talking about people who have forms of income. And in a sense, the question there is to understand precarity in this context as something more than a position in the labor market. And some scholars have talked about this double precarity of insecure employment and insecure housing. And since we're talking about London, there is also the question of place. So for many, staying in London was the only way of accessing certain types of job, but at the same time, staying in London required basically submitting and accepting that they would never be able to have a sort of a secure form of tenure in the city. I also wanted to add to this that since the standards assured short-term tenancy agreement is the most common legal tenancy in England and Wales, many guardians interviewed actually, somewhat paradoxically, said that actually living as a guardian was the most stable and probably in terms of location and value for money, the better form of living that they could find, being unable to enter the sort of the property ladder and buy a property. So in a sense, I think we also need to put that into perspective in relation to what kind of tenures are available to people right now.
I know you touched upon this when you mentioned the neoliberal processes taking place in the city, but how can property guardianship be understood in relation to wider urban transformations, including the financialization of housing?
Yeah, that's a very, it's a very good question. So I think, again, we need to position guardianship, which is a very, in a sense, is a very, very minor phenomenon, but we need to position that in relation to wider trends. And one trend which scholars of financialization of housing and property financialization have identified is that the introduction of short leases has become one of the really key trends to make rental markets more flexible, and by that, not more flexible necessarily for the people living in them, even though that's often what the political discourse would kind of use to coach these changes, but it's rather to make it more flexible for investors. And so the reduction of tenants' protections that have taken place in a number of different European countries have gone hand in hand with processes of, in a sense, of financial investment in the property market, and have enabled these investments to, in a sense, to turn housing into liquidity. So in that process of transforming housing into financial assets and using housing, in a sense, to fix capital in different places, the liquidity, the ability to obtain vacant possession has become very prized. And so in this sense, when tenants have weak security, when guardians don't have much more security, basically the same security against eviction as tenants, we have a system that enables and really facilitates that potential to increase prices and sell or rent out when it's at the most convenient. And so the licensed living through property guardianship really needs to be put into context with temporary tenancies, which have been emerging with the withdrawal of the state, with the deregulation of the rental markets throughout Europe and beyond, but also with the kind of with the demands of particular real estate, transnational real estate investors, but not only, to in a sense realize that liquidity and being able to engage with that liquidity. And so I think what was interesting for us looking at London was to understand how that financialization takes place on the one hand in the private rental market. So clearly private property owners kind of selling and buying to realize profit, but also in the shift between with the withdrawal of the state from some sections of the housing market. And so that's where council estates or housing association estates come into play, in that, in a sense, macro, I suppose, withdrawal and kind of offering of those properties to the open market. And so in that sense, Vasudevan and I have talked about looking at vacancy and thinking about vacancy and precarious licensing together to think about the edges of the city, to think about those places where these processes become really visible and in a sense give us a hint of the city to come.
Thank you, Mara, for giving us such a thick description of property guardianship in the UK and drawing out the lessons that we might want to consider moving forward for progressing planning. Is there any last word you'd like to give?
Maybe just to say that all the research we have done was always based on the assumption that we absolutely understand and recognize why people may want to live as property guardians. We're not here to blame. We're here to understand and make visible the systemic and more, I suppose, structural dimensions of the condition, but also acknowledge that there might be multiple motives and that really, in a sense, guardianship shows a whole host of different ways of inhabiting cities in terms of labor, in terms of precarity of place, in terms of also life trajectories, which I think are not fully captured by a structural analysis. But thank you very much for these questions. They were really great.
Thank you for listening to this episode, and thanks to Mara Ferrari for talking to us. For further information, you can visit our blog at this address, www.blog.lse.ac.uk/progressingplanning.